Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. What is going on? The markets and interest rates, the president and the Fed. Oh, and also, Questlove from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In New York City once again today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 11th day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Quite a couple of days on Wall Street, huh? 3% or more to the downside yesterday, another 2.5% or so at the lows today. It is a bit, shall we say, off-putting after a relatively long period of calm to the upside, I should add. So to put it all into some context, Marketplace's Mariel Segarra is here in the studio with me. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So lots of volatility, a word we haven't heard in a long time. What's going on?
So there's been a lot of speculation about this. What I'm hearing is there are a few things going on right now. The Federal Reserve has been hiking interest rates. We know that. That makes it more expensive for companies to borrow money. It can also slow down the economy. Mm-hmm. And then there's the U.S. and China and all the tariffs we've seen. You know, last month, the U.S. put tariffs on another $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. Now we've got tariffs on half of the stuff we import from China. And that's making it more expensive for some companies to do business. Also, we've seen indications that the Chinese economy is slowing. Its currency is falling. All of these things can make investors nervous. The question is really why this is happening now, as in today and yesterday. This stuff has been going on for a while, so that's hard to say.
All right. So as I said, give me the context here. I mean, these are some big numbers, right? 1,300 points on the Dow, a bunch on the NASDAQ, and the S&P, they're down as well. Frame that for me, would you?
Yeah, those are scary numbers, but you got to put this into perspective. In terms of percentages, the drops aren't so big. So 1,300 points in the Dow, that's 5%. And even with this sell-off, we haven't hit a market correction yet. You know, that's when an index falls by at least 10%. Right. And if you look at the trends, the Dow and the NASDAQ are both up by about 10% in the past year. The S&P is up by 7%. So what I've been hearing from analysts is that at this point, we're still talking about a bad couple of days.
All right. I will take that and we can run with it. Do me a favor, though, and spitball this. With the caveat that past performance is no indicator of future results, give me like tomorrow, a Friday, and the short-term future. What are we looking at?
Well, we're in a lull right now. Investors don't have a lot of new information to go on. The last Fed meeting was in September. We're in between earnings seasons. But earnings season kicks off tomorrow with the banks. JP Morgan, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, they'll all report earnings. And that could snap investors out of this because they will get some hard data to base decisions on. And so things could go up, especially if companies are doing well and the fundamentals look strong.
Which companies are, and the fundamentals have been strong, right? I mean, we have to admit that, right? Jobs are growing, the economy's growing, so the underlying reality is solid.
That's true. That's what I've been hearing.
Marketplace's Mariel Segarra on the Market Beat today. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, so we will turn now to three snapshots from the President of the United States, three glimpses into his thinking on monetary policy, interest rates, in other words, and what the Federal Reserve has been doing with them, namely, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra sitting right there just said, raising them three times this year, if you are counting, and we are, and so is the president, which gets us to this. First of all, this from the president last night in Erie, Pennsylvania. Apologies, by the way, for the background noise.
I think the Fed is making a mistake. They're so tight. I think the Fed has gone crazy.
Then this morning from a call he made to Fox and Friends.
You know, the Federal Reserve is getting a little bit too cute, that's all. That's ridiculous what they're doing.
And then finally, later this morning, from a bill signing ceremony in the Oval Office.
I think the Fed is far too stringent, and they're making a mistake, and it's not right. And it's, despite that, we're doing very well, but it's not necessary, in my opinion. And I think I know about it better than they do, believe me.
So if you're a business and economics journalist, what do you do with that? Because the president is just wrong. The Fed is not crazy or cute or stringent. The central bank, under both its current and immediate past chairs, has been deliberate and transparent and measured as it sets about getting interest rates back to something near normal after a decade of keeping them at zero. Also, by the way, when I asked Jay Powell back in July if it bugs him when the White House pokes him in the eye on monetary policy or whether it's going to change what he does, he said, if you listen between the lines here, nah.
I had a great colleague and mentor back in the day who used to bring meetings into focus by saying, let's control the controllable. So what we control is what we do. What we do, and I just told you what we do, and what we're always going to do. That's who we are. It's always who we're going to be. We're going to do our business in a way that's strictly non-political, without taking political issues into consideration, and that, you know, carries out the mandate Congress has given us. We have the tools to do that. We have a statute that allows us to do that in a way that is independent of political considerations. I'm strongly committed to it, and so are my colleagues.
So where is all this going? Well, it bears a mention here that this whole thing we've been talking about the past, what, five, 6.5 minutes, whatever, markets tumbling, rates rising, the Fed doing what it's doing, the president doing what he is doing, it's all anchored, all of it, in the knock-on effects of one economic reality whose name is inflation. The Fed, as we told you, would like to see prices rising by about 2% a year. We got some new inflation numbers this morning, and Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on what they may or may not mean.
The Consumer Price Index tracks prices for a basket of goods and services. In August, it was up 0.1%, landing at 2.3% year over year.
Inflation is at a moderate level. It's very close to where actually the Federal Reserve would like to see it.
Ann Owen teaches economics at Hamilton College.
I think that it's an endorsement of their current plan to continue to raise interest rates very gradually.
But numbers are funny. You could use those same CPI numbers to make a different argument. Economist Ernie Tedeschi at Evercore ISI sums up the counterpoint.
The Fed has a 2% inflation target. These numbers are close to 2%. Why on earth would we be raising rates?
Tedeschi says the Fed isn't just looking at where inflation is now. It's looking at where it's headed. Plus, the Fed isn't all that attached to CPI.
The main piece of data they look at for their inflation target is a different price inflator called PCE.
Or personal consumption expenditures, which measures inflation a little differently. Take healthcare. CPI measures how much you spend out of pocket. PCE tracks how much your healthcare costs everyone. You, the insurance company, the government. And, says Tedeschi, PCE looks at how people actually spend money.
It takes into account that if the price of apples goes up, a household might switch to buying pears instead.
Central bankers use both measures, just weight them differently. Presidential complaints about interest rates, probably light on the scale. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, what's that expression? Oh yeah, forget about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you watch late-night TV, the Tonight Show in particular, you probably know, or at least know of, the house band The Roots. And perhaps you would recognize its drummer and frontman, Questlove, big guy always with a pick in his afro. What you might not know, though, is that he's a DJ, too, and a producer, and an author, a foodie, also, and a podcaster on Pandora. Questlove Supreme is the name of it, if you want to check it out. And he came into the studio today. Questlove, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Most of the people who are going to hear this, my guess would be, and probably most of the people who know you now as the guy that you are, know you from TV and the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Even though you've had a, you know,
I've had
hip-hop band
before
for
this.
20 years, man.
Hey, you never know. I mean, George Foreman helps your sandwich.
Had a whole thing before
it's
the Foreman
like really
grill, right?
Heavyweight champion? No, never knew that. I knew early I was going to be all things to all people. At least people are getting spot on now, you know. Previously, I was, you're the guy that drums with Jay-Z, right? Or
yeah.
Even to this day, it's like, You're Jimmy Kimmel's drummer, right? Yeah, even worse, Jimmy Fallon gets, you're Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, yeah, so, of course he does.
I think at first it was a little, it throws you off a little bit. You know, it's like people have history. Like I just didn't pop up, you know, out of nowhere. But I'm fine with that.
Do you ever look around and say, I'm just a kid from Philadelphia, man. What am I doing here?
More or less, it's how did I get here? Often when I go back to Philadelphia, I do something called chasing ghosts. I still have my first car, and I keep it at my
mom's. I'm sorry, you still have your first car?
I still utilize it, yeah. And I go to my mom's house, and I get it. And usually I drive around. When I go to Philly, I'll drive from like midnight to 3 in the morning, literally just chase ghosts. And the thing I always do is when I go past the place where the Roots used to busk on 5th and South Street.
Yeah.
I'm always like, yo, like back in 1992, I thought 1999 was going to be the future, you know?
Yeah.
Let alone would I still be a thing in 2018? I mean, I'm not one of those knock on wood people that like, I don't want to jinx it, but.
As he knocks on wood?
As I did it, you know, hypothetically. But I'm amazed that no one's kicked me out the pool yet.
Yeah. We had Dessa on the program about 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And we had a whole thing about she got Lin-Manuel Miranda called her and, you know, and she's doing really well. And I said, you know, are you made now? And she said, oh, honey, you're never made.
Even, you know, this is our 27th professional year as a group. And I still work as if this could all end tomorrow. That's why people ask, like, well, you do so many things. You have 19 jobs. Like, when do you get to relax? And
you just don't.
In my mind, it's always this could end tomorrow. So don't ever sleep, you know.
Does it ever surprise you that you have become that guy now to whom people turn to for advice and mentorship? And
I'm very uncomfortable with that. Even my Twitter handle says, like, I'm better as a student, not a teacher. Like, this whole Questlove is sage scholar.
Yeah.
A bunch of
celebrity,
rappers.
Celebrity, right? You're
a bunch of rappers calling me, like, OG. No, I kind of shrug at that.
Would you be here without The Tonight Show? I mean, you have said that you looked at that Tonight Show gig as a way to sort of fade into the sunset.
I'm resilient, so I would like to think that I'd always be into something, but I would be a fool if I didn't tell you that The Tonight Show opened up even way more doors than I expected. Like, I truly thought this was going to be the most gentle mercy killing ever. No, I did.
I'm just laughing because it's funny. I'm not laughing because you're
like, not once did I think, like, oh, this could benefit you. You know, because I was reading all the op-eds, and even though I love being underestimated, someone had wrote in a blog once, like, oh, this is a sad day for music because watching The Roots accept this Tonight Show gig will be like watching Miles Davis busk in a New York subway for change.
Oh, man.
And I was actually like, good. This is exactly what I want. I want to be underestimated because I wanted to kill all perceptions of this being a square gig.
And yeah. Do you buy the sort of the conventional wisdom that you've changed late night music?
I mean, there's small nuances, but I think just the times have changed. I think we just got very lucky with the timing. The internet and social media had just started to become a thing. Yeah. Something like the idea of viral videos was becoming a thing. And we took advantage of it. Like, we were the young kid on the block, and it was clear, like, Letterman wasn't going to start being on Snapchat and that sort of thing. So we just took advantage of an empty playing field. You know, a lot of late night shows were just post-jazz music. There were other avenues to explore, and we took full advantage of it.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because there's a lineage, right? There's Doc Severinsen from the old Tonight Show, and then there's Paul Schaefer, probably the next notable guy, and now there's you and The Roots.
That's weird. And, you know, again, like, I didn't have posters of Severinsen and Schaefer on my wall. One day that'll be me. It's just making the most of it. Again, like, in 2008, when he proposed it to us.
Yeah. And we should say, you didn't take the call for a long time.
Yeah, I was like, oh, man, we just got to a place where we're making good money on the road. Like, why would we turn back on 17 years of climbing a mountain to start all over again? And, you know, the one thing is that where we were failing miserably was in our domestic personal lives.
Huh.
Kids were getting older, crying more at the airport. So it was sort of like we weren't actively asking for it, but it was like, man, if there's a way that we could Celine Dion our way into a position.
No, I like that.
I use all the stuff as verbs, right?
Yeah.
Celine Dion our way into a position where we could still make a good living without having to have lobby call at 4 a.m. and be on the bus for 9 hours and that sort. And then this fell into our lap, and it was like, be careful for what you ask for.
There's a – this is going to get all marketplace and you know, dorky management on you here, but
– I live for that stuff.
Well, good. And in fact, that's the root of the question, right? Because you have said at more than a couple of points, planning something is the joy of actually doing that something. And the question that comes out of it – the question that comes out of it is, what's it like to work for you? How do you run the band? How do you run the Roots? How do you run you guys on the show?
You know, there's lessons to be learned about it because, again, we're at a phase in our lives where we're not 22, 23 like we used to be.
You're what, 45 now, right?
Yeah, I wish. Okay, 47.
47, right.
I'm 47. Sorry, so the things that I would like to do, like, you know, relentless rehearsals for 7 hours in a row and that sort of thing that we used to do, you know, you got to kind of be considered the fact that it might be soccer night or, you know, that sort of thing. Not to mention a lot of our side projects. Well, it's weird because, one, the Roots is just one of 19 things I'm responsible for.
Right.
We're in a very sweet spot right now where we're actually having more fun with each other socially.
Which is great, right?
That we've ever had. I'd realized that we were going to fall apart if, as people, we weren't having fun with each other. You know what I mean? So I think now just we're in as a unit. This is the best it's ever been.
We're going to end it right there. Oh. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
If you're not one of the very large players, you better be offering some niche products.
True in life, true also in retirement planning. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. 2 days in a row, the Wawas, I don't know about this. Dow Industrial's off 545 today, 2.1%, 25,052. NASDAQ shed 92 points, 1.2%, 73.29. The S&P 500 off 57, 2%, 27.28. Their banks dipped along with bond yields. Wells Fargo dropped 1.8%. Citigroup gave back 2.2%. Bank of America declined 3%. Today, energy stocks sagged as oil prices hit a two-week low. ExxonMobil was down 3.4%. Valero gave up 3.5%. Chevron down another 3.4% today. Delta Airlines shot up 3.5% after posting profit that exceeded expectations. The company cited higher revenue from first and business class passengers. JetBlue, though, lowered 2.5% today. Bond prices rose. Get this, the yield on the 10-year Treasury note actually fell today, down to 3.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. Mark in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, wrote to tell us how much he appreciates the way Marketplace presents in-depth news and tells offbeat economic stories he doesn't find anyplace else. If you agree with Mark, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Retirees and others in this economy who get Social Security benefits are going to get a little bit of a bump in January, a 2.8% cost of living adjustment. That's about $40 a month on average. The government makes that adjustment every year to help people keep up with inflation. There's that word again. And the 2019 increase is the biggest in 7 years. Marketplace's Renata Sago explains the micro and the macro economic impact.
Right now, David Covington gets about $600 a month in Social Security benefits, and he'll tell it to you straight. Living in Cleveland, Ohio in 2018 with health bills and a home in need of repair, the 68-year-old says he's thankful for the money he gets, but a 2.8% cost of living increase, heck, any increase, well...
It would sure help to at least keep up with inflation. Inflation is going up outrageous.
Yep, food prices are creeping up, same with gas, and healthcare costs keep climbing too, according to economist Andrew Briggs with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute. He says we'd enjoyed a run of relatively low inflation, but first policy shifts, then Mother Nature changed that.
One reason for the increase in prices last year was the impact of hurricanes.
For Cheryl Moody, who's 66 and lives in Las Vegas, a small benefit increase every few years is not enough to keep up with her costs. She already lives with a roommate, spends about half of her $1,600 monthly payment on rent, and she expects rent to go up.
Social Security should have a cost of living increase every year.
72-year-old Joanne Weed in Orlando, Florida, gets a little over $1,000 a month. She's been receiving Social Security for 6 years and says she would use the extra money she gets for groceries.
But I know how it's going to come out. They're going to raise the Medicare premiums and we won't get the 2.8.
News on any Medicare hikes won't be out until later this year. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Renata was talking about Social Security, the biggest cost of living adjustment American seniors have gotten in years. Again, thank you, inflation. But the flip side of that is that roughly 1 in 3 people in this economy have less than $5,000 set aside for their retirement. Part of that, of course, is human nature, not wanting to think about the inevitable. But part of it is that saving for retirement has historically been expensive with fees and charges and whatnot. The good news is that that's changing. Management fees for some mutual funds have dropped to fractions of a percent. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, eventual retirees have started to buy in.
42-year-old Evan List is a software engineer in Ohio. He began saving for retirement in his mid-20s, but when he started investing, he didn't pay close attention to what he was invested in. He let his broker take care of that. Eventually, he did something a lot of us do from time to time. He reckoned with his mortality.
As I've gotten older, of course, that's retirement staring down on all of us, and I pay more attention to it.
He asked his broker for 10 years of statements and realized his broker's investments were charging him higher fees than he needed to pay. So he moved his money to funds with much lower fees. He and his broker went their separate ways.
There's certainly anxiety because you're going out on your own. I trusted this advisor for decades, literally decades.
List is part of a wave of investors that have poured money into cheaper funds over the last decade. And investment companies like Vanguard and Charles Schwab, which underwrites this program, have been scrambling to undercut each other. Yale finance professor James Choi says the pressure is getting intense.
There's a question of whether at some point the market would move to negative fee funds where you get paid in exchange for investing money.
How can a big investment company charge microscopic fees? One reason, the funds are pretty easy to run. They're called index funds, which simply mimic the likes of the S&P 500.
Given that market forces have pushed these fees down to something very close to zero, going all the way to zero may not have been that big of a sacrifice.
And it's not as though big investment firms are going all the way to zero to make you smile. Choi says, remember, companies like Fidelity sell a lot of other stuff too. Here's a recent TV ad for one of those services.
At Fidelity, our online U.S. equity trades are just $4.95.
The old loss leader strategy. Kathleen Smith is a principal at Renaissance Capital.
It's like going into the supermarket and they have chicken on sale and they're selling it at a much lower price than their cost.
Except that cheap chicken is next to other things you might want to buy for your cookout, like delicious spices and some charcoal briquettes. If Fidelity is the supermarket, Smith's company is the free-range butcher next door. It sells specialty funds made up of newly public companies. Smith says the smaller firms like hers have to get artisanal.
If you're not one of the very large players, you better be offering some niche products.
Those products have higher fees, but Smith said she's tried to keep them as low as possible. Ben Carlson, an investment advisor at Ritholtz Wealth Management, says the great fee wars have no end in sight.
There's going to be a never-ending, you know, lineup of new funds that are going to get thrown against the wall, and these fund companies will hope something sticks.
The sheer number of options out there has turned the fund market into a Costco for investing. But are the stacks of low-fee funds really all that different from each other?
Once you get into a low-cost index fund, whether it's at Vanguard or Charles Schwab or Fidelity, and it's not some other place that's charging you an arm and a leg, I think you've already kind of won in a lot of ways in terms of fees.
Carlson says things are pretty good for investors right now, as long as those low fees don't tempt them into making bad trades. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which inflation cements its place as the somewhat inadvertent theme of the broadcast. You know where else prices are going up? The post office. The USPS has announced it wants to raise the price of a forever stamp by a nickel to 55 cents for a first class letter. That nickel, if you do the math, is a 10% price hike, the biggest increase since 1991, as the Postal Service continues its fight against email and all the rest. Still does have to be approved by the Postal Regulatory Commission, though. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's off 545 today. That's 2.1%. That's 1,300 points, plus or minus, in 2 days for the Dow. The NASDAQ off 92 points, 1.2%. S&P 500 off 57 points, 2%. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.